Hi, welcome back to Undisclosed Towards Justice. This is Rabia. I'm here with my colleague, as always, Colin Miller. Hey, Colin.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm well. How are you?
Prepping for classes. They start a week from tomorrow, so looking forward to meeting my new students.
Oh, boy. In a week, my daughter goes off to college, and if I could stop the hands of time, I can't even tell you. It's killing me. But anyhow, well, good luck with that. And we are excited to welcome on what is, I promise, our final episode of this series, author and advocate Tammy Mell. Hi, Tammy.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. This is, I think, the first time we've actually had you on as a guest to talk through, right? Or have you been on in the series? I don't think so.
Nope, this is first time.
All right, great. Thank you for coming on. There's a few issues that I wanted to talk about. We have a bunch of listener questions, but it's interesting. A number of the comments that we've gotten, and I want to address this up front, have been that people have said that, you know, like, what's going on? It didn't feel like it was enough episodes. Like, we wanted more episodes. Undisclosed seasons are so much longer. There's like, and I think it's the fact that folks just want more information about the case. So this season was 11 episodes, 11 scripted episodes. But if you include the addendum in today's episode, that's 23 episodes. The Jason Carroll season was 10 episodes and Greg Lance was 12. So I don't know. Folks are just, maybe you're remembering Undisclosed from like Adnan days or Joy Watson days when they were like 25 episodes or something, like without the addendum. I'm not sure.
Tammy, I had a question to start with, which is, I'm very curious. We noted in this series that you came into the case thinking Patty was guilty, and through your investigation, obviously, you came convinced of her innocence. Can you think back in time, Tammy, to when you first entered this case? Do you know what it was, your initial impression, that led you to believe that she was guilty at first?
Well, I think it was what has led so many other people, which is you read DNA match. Mm-hmm. They found her DNA at the crime scene. She's guilty. But another reason I will tell you is that the coverage was so biased against her. I read nothing good about this woman. Nothing. You know, when I start researching a case, I begin with newspaper articles, archived newspapers. There was nothing written good about her. I mean, it was just terrible, the coverage. So, yes, I had that feeling that, you know, this woman is guilty. And it didn't turn out that way, though, for me.
Well, can I ask you, at what point, following that up, it started to change for you? Like, was there one thing that made you think, wait a minute, how long did it take?
You know what? It didn't take long because I had tried to contact different people and no one would either respond to me or talk to me if I did get a hold of them. And then the one thing that really, really changed it for me, the only one who wanted to talk was Patty Rohr. And then it was when I got a phone call from a detective at the Lehigh County District Attorney's Office who basically said to me, you know, what do you want to go digging into this case for? Nobody wants you looking into this case. And then my first thought was, why? Mm. What's in there you don't want me to see, you know? And that was really the changing point. And then, of course, the more I talked to Patty, the more she would back up what she was saying with either, you know, police report, a lab report, trial transcript, whatever it was. Mm. What she was telling me is what was true. And it was a lot of stuff I had never heard about. So,
yeah,
that's how that happened.
I mean, it's these kind of details, you know, the kind of details we report or you've reported in your book, you're not going to find that newspaper recording at all. And folks don't understand that. And it is really hard to counter like the media narratives. But So, you know, there's a few issues that I wanted to discuss that we did not get into the podcast at all that are just kind of weird little issues. And the first one is this, and that is that, and Colin, I actually kind of punted this to Colin because I want him to address, like, how is this possible? But that two of the Pennsylvania state troopers who were investigators on the case actually were co-prosecutors in this case. They weren't just sitting at counsel's table, like at the state's table. They were actually named as co-prosecutors. It's in the trial transcripts. The judge is like, are you a co-prosecutor? Yes, I'm a co-prosecutor. Excuse me, what? Colin, how does this happen?
So there's two things. So one is the general, and that is to say we have Federal Rule of Evidence 615 and state counterparts. Those are rules of witness sequestration. So if a party is a person, like Patty Rohrer, she can't be sequestered from the courtroom. If a party is an entity, like the prosecutor in the case, they're allowed to name one person as case agent, often a police officer, FBI agent in federal courts, who can be at the prosecution table. They can also additionally have someone who is essential to the presentation of their case as a second person at the table. The second part, Ravia, where you're noting they're named as co-prosecutors, there are a few states, Pennsylvania being one, South Carolina being another, where even though they're not attorneys, police officers are able to serve either as co-prosecutors or in South Carolina, in some cases, as lead prosecutors. There's some talks about reforming that now. But yeah, I mean, I think your concern is well warranted, but there are these sort of old rules in some states and commonwealths that do allow what was done here.
By the way, both of these guys, this Egan and Cochevar, were also witnesses in the case.
Mm-hmm.
They testified. And because they're there, they're not then sequestered from the rest of the testimony. So my question is, it's not like they ever got up and they didn't litigate, they didn't question, they didn't do it. Like, why were they there? What is the strategic value of having them as co-prosecutors? Just to allow them to see the whole case?
They don't need to be prosecutors to do that, because Rule 615, if they're not prosecutors, they can't be sequestered. So I'm not sure what the utility is in having them be co-prosecutors if they're not actually interrogating witnesses or doing anything.
They never
like that.
Did.
Yeah.
Tammy, were you ever able to kind of understand, get your like head around that? Like, why that came about, how that came about? Like, I looked in your book. I even looked in our district attorney friend's book, and I found really no explanation for it.
I have never found an explanation either. I have seen it in other cases. In Pennsylvania cases, most of them are very, very old cases. I don't think it's common. That's my own opinion,
yeah.
But I'm not sure about that.
Jennifer did a quick search, but you know, her search was just like through media archives, and she found one other case. That was a much older case. That's true. But I'm just trying to understand the why behind it. Like, how do they benefit from this is what I'm confused about. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyone in Pennsylvania or in South Carolina who knows, for being co-prosecutors as police officers, please let us know.
Yeah, yeah. Or if you like served, you know, as defense counsel in a trial, and this is, you've come across this, like, you know, why does this happen? All right, okay. So the second thing I want to talk about, and Tammy is, and this was actually stems from a question that somebody actually raised, but I want to talk this kind of as an issue because of how strongly I feel about this is. How do you personally feel, and after your investigation, about Andy as kind of like the prime suspect that has that needs to be eliminated in the case?
I think that there are a lot of questions I would like to ask Andy. Mm-hmm. I would not want to say I feel Andy did it. I don't know who did it, but I think that there are some questions that have never been investigated completely. You know, like his changing stories at what time he left for work that morning and, you know, why he compromised all the scenes before they were investigated. There are different things that I would very much like to ask him about.
So, you know, I mean, like, we also can't be like, well, this person definitely did. Like, we have no way of knowing. Because as far as I'm concerned, he wasn't investigated properly, which is why we always frame it as, like, this is a suspect that needs to be eliminated. I don't think he was properly eliminated. A couple of things, points I wanted to raise, and a couple of reasons I believe that is, well, first of all, I want to remind people that he immediately kind of planted the seeds pointing to two different suspects, right? Like immediately from the jump. And one was his wife's ex-husband, right? Because remember he told the police that a number of people have seen a black truck. It's got to be this guy, Michael's black truck. Except that when the police then followed up, they found out that Andy himself was the one who was telling people that there was a black truck. Or I thought, you know, he is the one. The black truck rumor started with Andy, whereas he framed it the other way around, which is suspicious to me, period. Because we're not talking about weeks and months later that Andy's being asked and he's saying, oh yeah, somebody mentioned a black truck. This is right then and there. It is like from the second day he's saying, people told me that there's a black truck. No, but you told people. So that's makes no sense to me. And then, of course, Patty, which I've said over and over, of all the people, I mean, he could have thought that, you know, something happened to his wife. I would have been like, there's like hundreds of men in this area because of all the different kinds of like industrial businesses happening. All kinds of strangers in this area, people coming and going. It's a busy area. I would have been like, she might have gone out for a walk and like some guy could have, you know what I mean? Like for his mind to go to North Carolina, doesn't make sense to me. Anything you want to say about that? Those two things, Colin, first, before I move on?
The question I've always had in my mind, this goes back to like episode one, season one of Undisclosed and Confabulation. Yeah. And that is, does he really think that Patty called a couple days before Joe disappeared? That's mixed up in his head. I could see his mind going there, not realizing it was actually, you know, a few weeks earlier. So if it's that mistake in his head, I can see him doing it. If he is deliberately creating this impression in the officers' minds that she had just called, that's something very different.
I love being a homeowner. Owning a home is great until it's not. As my listeners know, we had to cancel an episode recording last week because what happened? Well, my sump pump failed and we had torrential rains. And before I knew it, my basement was full of water. So the thing about repairs is they don't care about timing. These kinds of things definitely don't care about your budget. And I found out fast that my regular homeowner's insurance did not cover not just that, but it doesn't cover a lot of the day-to-day wear and tear like plumbing failures, HVAC breakdowns, electrical issues. You're often on your own for those. That is where HomeServe comes in. It's like a subscription for your home. For as little as $4.99 a month, they've got your back. Repairs hit fast and hard. You could be searching for a contractor in panic, or you could already be on the phone with HomeServe's 24/7 hotline scheduling a repair. It is super simple. Just choose a plan for your needs and budget, and when something on your plan goes wrong, just call their 24/7 hotline to start the repair process. HomeServe has helped homeowners like us for over 20 years with a trusted national network of 2,600 local contractors. They've got 4.5 million customers, a 4.8 out of 5 post-repair rating, and an A+ Better Business Bureau rating. They are the real deal. As a single mom who is a homeowner and cannot repair anything, I sleep better knowing HomeServe has my back. So like me, join the millions of customers who trust HomeServe. For 50% less your first year, go to homeserve.com/justice. That is homeserve.com/justice for 50% less. Savings compared to renewal price. Void in Florida. Here's the thing. Kathy Holschwander was the woman whose house he was working, mm-hmm. Kathy and Tom, he was working at their home that week and maybe the week prior. I don't know how long he'd been working at the house, the project he was working on. She was interviewed by police maybe a month or two later. It was not in the immediate aftermath. And she said that she remembered that she could get her dates wrong, but she said that she remembered that on that Tuesday. So Andy's narrative is that Patty called on Monday, Thursday, his wife goes missing. Okay. Kathy is saying on that Tuesday, she remembered Andy joking about the phone call from the day before. I can see him confabulating it days later.
Right.
But the next day saying last night she called and this strange happened, that I don't believe. Like that, like what is happening there? Why is she remembering that conversation like that? If that's actually what Andy said, and why is he making that up as well? Again, I'm like, what kind of seeds are being planted here? The other thing we didn't talk about, and I'm going to have you discuss this, Tammy, is the whole issue of Officer York and Officer Kishka. I don't think we brought this up at all during the season, but are you able to walk us through this?
So Officer Kishka was the first officer to come to the Katranack home when they were reported missing.
And he's a local officer. He wasn't Pennsylvania State Police.
Yes, he's a Catasauqua officer.
Yeah.
Or was. Mm-hmm. He spent only 18 minutes, I believe, at the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, at trial, the whole thing at trial was that, you know, the door was broken in, the basement door was broken in, those 20 screws were taken out or partially taken out. But then years later, a man named Joe York, who was also a police officer, a Whitehall, I believe, police officer, he called Patty's attorneys and he said that he had worked with Joe Kiska and that Officer Kiska had told him that there actually was no break-in at the Katranack home that night, that he specifically checked that basement door and it was not broken into, the screws were not removed, and that when he told his superior officers or someone in the Lehigh County District Attorney's office, he was told to keep his mouth shut if he wanted to remain working in law enforcement.
Right.
So that was the story there. Joe York did sign an affidavit attesting to that. Later, Officer Kiska denied he ever said it, but there were a few little things in there that made me think that it probably did happen. And one of them was that Joe York had immediately called Patty's attorneys, I believe.
He had apparently seen like some media coverage, right? And that made him
reach out. Yeah, he had called someone in the at a newspaper or in the media, and that person remembered getting that call. So that tended to make me believe that that probably did happen.
Right. Right. And also, why would he just make that up? Like, police officers are not like that. Police officers, I mean, this is a band of brothers, right? Like, they're pretty tight with each other.
They are, but also stop and think about the 18 minutes at the house.
Yeah.
You know, if a woman and an infant child are reported missing and they do find signs of a break-in at the house, do they blow it off like they blew this off?
Yeah.
But if they find nothing, is it kind of like, look, you know, she said she was going shopping. She's just a couple hours late. It's Christmas. Traffic's heavy. You know, I just don't think they would have blown it off the way they did in this case if there were these signs.
And the other interesting thing, a couple more things about, you know, whether or not Officer Kiska saw signs of a break-in when he first went. And that's this, that Gary D'Angelo, Officer Gary D'Angelo, he was one of the responding officers when he got the call, like at 5:30 a.m. Remember when the call was made that, oh, I found the phone line cut, right? And at that time, the way he described it in his testimony was that he looked at the door, he saw the hasp loose in nature. The hasp is where the padlock is, like, you know, locked in through. But he said nothing about there being loose in screws. The first time in any police reports that there are mentions of the screws being loosened are the next morning on the 16th when Detective Grube takes a report. Grube, by the way, also says, and this is I got from your book, and I wanted to know what the source of this was, that he found that Andy was really calm. His demeanor was, quote, not of a distraught husband. Grube was bothered by the fact that Andy had spliced the phone line together before the police got there. And he also was like, wow, Andy seems to have everything figured out. So do you remember if Detective Grube, like this was in your book, Tim, do you remember if this was something he testified to, said in the media and his reports, where this came from?
It was said in the media. It was said on either Murder in Lehigh Valley or Wrong Man. I can't remember which one. It must have been Murder in Lehigh Valley when he was interviewed. And yes, he did say that Andy seemed to have an answer for everything. I think that they were looking at Andy, you know, from the start. And then, of course, the Pennsylvania State Police took it away from them after a couple days. And that was the end of basically their investigation there. And the PSP went a totally different way.
Yeah. Another strange thing, this ties into like questions around Andy's dad and parents, because, you know, we have mentioned it numerous times that his only alibi was, I guess, his dad, who he apparently was working with that day. So one of the things Andy's dad says, that he says that when he got to the house that night, he says that he got there at 10 p.m., and that's not possible. He said, I got there at 10 p.m., and Joe's parents were there. Andy didn't call the police till 10:40. number one. And then Joe's family didn't arrive till 1 a.m. And again, and I mentioned this in the first or second episode, that no member of Joe's family ever said that they saw Andy's parents at the house that night. However, the other thing is Andy's dad says that when he got there that night, he saw that piece of plywood on the ground unscrewed. That's how he describes it. Except nobody else ever saw it like that. And that makes me wonder, did he see it before that piece of plywood was actually put up and partially screwed into place, making it look like a brick? I don't understand that. So Tammy, can you talk a little bit about Andy's dad and his statements and why it's been difficult to nail them down?
It has been very difficult to nail them down because that's one of the things that frustrated me so much, is that everybody was giving a different version of who was there at the time when they arrived. That I do recall him saying that about the plywood being on the ground.
Let's say he got there before Andy's parents came, before the police came, and he saw this plywood sitting on the ground, right? Maybe the plywood was on the ground because it hadn't been installed in the door yet. And maybe that's why none of the officers saw any of this until, I don't know. It's weird that he would say that. And this, I think his report, he says it in a report just like a day or two after this happens. Colin, thoughts?
My thoughts are mainly on Andy's mom.
Okay.
And I'm kind of curious where you both stand at this moment at the end of this series. I'm kind of one third, one third, one third. One third of me thinks Walter Trautman saw Joe on the day that Joe officially disappeared. Whether that's Andy or not is a separate question. That's one third. Walter Trautman is right. One third is that Andy's mom is lying about the phone call and the shopping trip, and that Joe, something had already happened to her before that morning. Mm-hmm. And then one third of me thinks, no, Trautman, mom's telling the truth. Something else happened we have to make sense of. And I wonder Tammy, I'll start with you. What are your takes on Trautman and Andy's mother's story? How much credibility or lack thereof do you give to both of those?
Trautman, I really don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
Andy's mother, I believe, was lying.
Mm-hmm.
Because she did change her story at trial.
Okay.
And I know I did put in the book about how she moved the time, and that by moving that time, she eliminated them from questioning how many people that would have been there at that time, if you know what I mean by that. She also,
from the diner you're talking about, who would have seen what happened.
Exactly. You know, there could have been more people to question.
Did she move it to, she moved it to a later time, right? If I'm remembering correctly.
She did, yes.
Okay.
So she moved it to where Joanne would have disappeared, say between 2 and 2:30 or something like that, rather than the 1:15.
Uh-huh.
And so that bothered me. The second thing was, she testified, I believe, that she never went into the basement, so she couldn't have missed Joanne. But that is not what she told the police in the beginning.
Right.
So that was not true. I also found it very funny that she would sit with her coat on for three hours at the window when, you know, and I also found it very strange that she made no attempt to find out what happened, either when Joanne didn't show up. You know, this was not Joanne saying, maybe I'll stop by, I might stop by. This was, I will be there in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
She's got a new baby. It's the middle of winter, and you don't even drive the route to see if she's broke down on the side of the road or have someone else drive. And then she doesn't call Andy when she knows Andy's home from work either. I didn't believe Veronica at all. I don't know if she was trying to protect her son, even if it was just a case of, oh my God, you know, if I don't say this, they're going to think he might have done it. I don't know what it was with her, but I didn't believe her at all.
Investigating wrongful conviction cases can mean facing hard questions and heavy emotions. Talkspace makes support easier to reach. with licensed therapists and nurse practitioners across all 50 states. Choose therapy through live chat, video, or audio sessions, and fit care into a busy routine. Plans start at $69 per week, and most insured members pay $0. If the match does not feel right, switching providers costs nothing extra. Support is available for individuals, teens, and couples. Taking care of mental health can be one steady step when life feels difficult to sort through. Talkspace is in network with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month when you go to Talkspace.com and enter promo code SPACE80. That's SPACE80. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com.
Well, you know, Colin, what you said about your one-third one, look, if Trotman was right, then Veronica's definitely lying. Uh-huh. For sure, right? Like, though, both those things can't be true. And somebody actually asked that question, has anyone from Undisclosed talked to the guy who heard the couple arguing about a baby's paternity? No, I mean, Trotman passed away. He's passed away. But he was deposed. He's given multiple statements. He was interviewed. So, you know, and all that stuff still exists. And then it was also raised in a post-conviction as Brady, right? But I think that was not an issue that the court found to be Brady because of the DNA stuff. We go keep going back to that. The court kept finding the DNA evidence was so overwhelming, it wouldn't have mattered. It wouldn't have prejudiced the jury.
Tammy, I just wanted to follow up. Listeners might be curious. I'm very curious as well. In terms of Andy's mother and the moving of the time of the phone call, I'm trying to remember, was there anything that she anchored the time of the phone call to? And is there an explanation given about why she changed the timing of the phone call that she supposedly had with Joe?
I honestly don't recall.
Okay.
I just remember it sticking out when I read the trial transcripts that it was like, wait a minute, that's not what she said. That's not what the story's been the whole time.
Okay.
In her initial reports, she did anchor it. She said that there was a radio show she listened to, if I remember correctly. Right, Tammy? There's a radio show. Yeah, there's a radio show she listened to. The radio show ended, and I guess the phone call happened, and then she went to do her laundry and then came up and waited because Joe would have been there, like, very soon thereafter. So she did anchor it to something specific. I mean, look, the trial didn't take place for a number of years. Maybe she got a little confused, but... You know, because I was like, okay, if this person is deliberately, and you know, I'm assuming she's an older lady, deliberately lying, then like, what is the benefit of that lie? I mean, the only benefit of any of this is to prove that Joe was actually still alive that day.
It supports the, right? I mean, to the extent we think that Andy has an alibi,
mm-hmm.
if Joe is on this phone call at a time that this alibi covers, right?
Right.
As
but if you change it from 1:30 to 2:30, like,
right.
Does it make a big difference?
Oh, the moving the time, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I'm not sure if it makes it. Like, what is the utility of that, of making that change deliberately? That's, I don't know. Unless they know. No, they. I don't think they would have even known about Trotman's reports at that point because Egan barely.
Does it matter for the alibi at all in terms of the work he was doing at the home between the two times? Do we know? The close wanderers, when they saw and didn't see him?
I mean, I think the only reason she might have moved it is what Tammy just said. It makes no sense why she'd stand at the window until her husband got home, like 2 hours later. If she said it was 2:30, well, her husband would have been, he was home by 3, right? So she could have been like, yeah, I got off the call, put on my coat, and he walked in the door. It was like right then. I mean, maybe narratively that makes mm-hmm. more sense then. And so maybe that was it.
Okay, but could it have affected his alibi? Because the window of opportunity, right,
mm-hmm.
with him at work would have only been until 3 o'clock, didn't it? Wasn't Tom Holschwander supposed to have come home around 3?
Around 3:30, yep, apparently.
And his father left at 3?
Mm-hmm.
So it would push the alibi.
Right.
It could push the alibi.
Right.
Because then it would give him that much less time.
Yeah,
if Joanne was still alive at that time.
Yeah. And, you know, people have also raised, like, you know, why we did not nail down Andy's timeline more specifically. And I think we kind of laid that out in the first episode or two. It's not possible. I mean, yeah. Right. Like, it's like every report has a different time that he left home. His parent, his father has given a different time. His father said he got to work first, then Andy got there. Andy says he got to work first and his father got there later. It's just not possible. And all we're working off are documents we have from 35 years earlier. So it's, nobody's been able to like kind of nail. And Kathy Hochschwender was not home all day. She didn't get home till the evening. The kids were at school all day. And Tom also wasn't home. I don't know. I don't think anybody saw Andy arriving at the house, right, Tammy?
I don't believe so, no.
Yeah.
Well, no, I think Kathy was there until about 11, wasn't she? And then she left. So okay. I think she did see him and his father there in the morning. And then she left for the day.
And her husband, after they had lunch together, they were kind of like gone for the rest of the day.
Right.
But for much of the day, it was just Andy and his dad at the house.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, like this is all, none of this even matters if Joe was not even alive on that. I'm like, you know what I mean? This is all presupposing right. that Joe was actually alive and out and about and doing anything. Who knows? Which if Trotman's right, then maybe she was.
Yeah. I mean, Tammy, in the last episode, we mentioned the neighbor hearing the gunshots. What's your take on that? Is that, you think, just something totally separate, or do you think that actually has some legs?
I mean, so I always dismiss that because of mm-hmm. the neighbor who says she saw Joanne that day mm-hmm. putting Alex in the car on December 15th. So then I didn't know, you know, uh-huh. if she's telling the truth, then the gunshots were unrelated. But she is the only one outside of Andy who saw Joanne that day.
Right. Unless, and her timeline wouldn't work with the mother's phone call because she sees Joe putting Alex in the car well before even the earlier time for the phone call, right?
That's true. Yes. Right. Yes. So it's just so, and what was so frustrating is they never pinned anybody down on anything. Never said to him, yeah. wait a minute. Last time I talked to you, you said you left at 6. Now you're telling me 7:30. What time did you leave? They pinned nobody down on anything.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, they put Andy through a few polygraphs and he failed them all. Look, okay. So on the issue of the woman seeing Joe, you know, leave and put the baby in the car, remember, this is the woman who did not report this to the police until the FBI came back to her and said, did you tell somebody else that you saw this? And she said, oh yeah, I did. I told another person, another neighbor that I saw this. That's why for me, I take that with a big grain of salt. She's interviewed, she's a next door neighbor. She's immediately interviewed the day after. Why wouldn't she tell the police at that time? Why did it take for her to tell a third party? That party tells the police and they come back to her. So I take that with a grain of salt because I feel like maybe she was just kind of like, she could be conflating days. I doubt it. It's literally the next day. Or I feel like she could just been like kind of making something up to make herself like, ooh, I saw the victim on the day she disappeared. I just don't believe it. And as far, and as for I went back and there's two different police reports that record the guy who says that he heard the gunshots. Huh? He heard the gunshots on the night between the 15th and the 16th. So at this point in the middle of the night, like at 3:30 a.m., that's around the same time that Andy's like, my phone's been cut. I need the police to come. The police right. are already involved. So and if the police are coming and going, I don't know when he heard it, what he heard, you know, it doesn't seem related. Basically.
Investigating wrongful conviction cases can mean facing hard questions and heavy emotions. Talkspace makes support easier to reach with licensed therapists and nurse practitioners across all 50 states. Choose therapy through live chat, video, or audio sessions and fit care into a busy routine. Plans start at $69 per week and most insured members pay $0. If the match does not feel right, switching providers costs nothing extra. Support is available for individuals, teens, and couples. Taking care of mental health can be one steady step when life feels difficult to sort through. Talkspace is in network with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off of your first month when you go to Talkspace.com and enter promo code SPACE80. That's SPACE80. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com.
All right, so we've got some questions, and I think I'll let Colin, why don't you take that first one?
All right, this is from liberal anti-theist.
Okay.
I think I'm pronouncing it correct. Anti-theist, like,
I guess.
Yeah. What do you think of the idea of professional jurors? I feel like having people with some critical thinking skills in a jury would diminish the likelihood of wrongful convictions. And if doctors and lawyers can maintain confidentiality, jurors should be able to as well. And so, Robbie, I'll start with you. What's your take on this thought of professional jurors? It's something that's been raised for years.
You know, like, instinctively, I'm like, yeah, let's get some pros on there. People who, like, you know, but, you know, I can also see the pitfalls in it, right? Like, it's like, because I don't know how that would work with the reasonable doubt standard, right? Necessarily that the average person would, it would be easier, I think, for them to find versus a, I don't know. And I wonder if a professional juror then inadvertently would become a professional investigator without meaning to, right? A professional everything, professional expert, forensic expert, all that. So I it's all going to come with some disadvantages, but I don't know. What about you?
Well, let me ask Tammy, as I think, fair to call you a citizen journalist in your endeavors. Mm-hmm. What's your take on this idea of the professional juror?
I am not for professional jurors. What I am very much for is doing away with sovereign immunity for prosecutors.
Thank
so
you.
They can no longer hide stuff and convict the innocent. That's what I'm for. They've got to be held responsible for this stuff. And if the, you know, if normal people had all the truth, I think that they would be able to figure out whether this person was innocent or guilty.
Yeah. My own take is, I guess, sort of somewhere in between what we have now in professional jurors, which is the grand jury model. Grand jury is asked to decide whether there's probable cause to issue a true bill and indictment and have the case go to trial. And grand jurors will sit together for months and hear multiple cases. I kind of like the idea of doing that with trial jurors, where it's not just a one-shot thing where, okay, your jury duty is for 2 months and you're going to hear 8 cases together. And that's going to give you not professional status where this is your perpetual job, but at least it's not just a one-off, the thinking being these jurors are going to grow and learn as they hear multiple cases.
But that would be a profession then. Nobody, like, in their normal day-to-day could do that. I mean,
no,
right?
I mean,
like,
it would, you know, but I mean, look, some trials do take months. And so to say, look, your jury duty once every 20 years is for 2 months to serve in a trial jury.
Yeah, yeah.
You can see it.
I mean, do you think this idea actually has any legs anywhere, though?
No.
No. But there you go. There you
go,
liberal anti-theist. Yeah. Okay. So the next question comes from Megan Weaver. And Tammy, I'm going to give this to you. Can anything be done about the fact that it's very obvious that the hairs were switched? Thank you, Megan. Isn't that new evidence? It's a root, no root issue wasn't found until later. Also, is DNA testing still a possibility with anything in the case for clothes, for example? I think listeners, like all of us, are very frustrated with what feels like hitting a wall in the DNA. So what are your thoughts on all that, Tammy?
Well, I mean, I believe that something can be done with the no roots attached report and the whole, which are Brady violations. And she is going into federal court. And I am pretty confident. I mean, I feel very good about it. I think she's got very good issues with a lot of merit. And I'm hoping she does see some type of relief from the federal courts.
Yeah. At this point in the state courts, like that issue has pretty much died. The issue of, like, we believe the hairs were switched. But, you know, the federal court has not seen the no root memo yet.
Yeah.
Even. Yeah.
I'll add my own evidentiary insight, which is to say, I believe from reading one of the opinions, the issue they found with the no root report is it lacked proper authentication. This is Federal Rule of Evidence 901 in Pennsylvania's counterpart. In other words, they said that Patty was not able to authenticate this, who created this document. What I would say for federal court purposes is there's an ancient document illustration under authenticity rules that says if the document is a certain number of years old, it's found you expect it to be, and there's no issues, this is a forgery, etc., you can authenticate it. And so authenticity is a big issue that I think might be litigated in federal court.
But Colin, can I ask you, I mean, on the issue of, like, Patty couldn't authenticate it, in what way do you authenticate it? By putting the person who created a report on the stand and asking them, did you create this report?
Yeah, or there's, you know, someone's name is on it or it's part of a report by the FBI.
But Tammy, wasn't the name on it? It was.
But who created it? You need evidence about who created this document and who wrote the
Rizzino. Rizzino, right, Tammy?
The No Roots Attached, that was not Rizzino.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not authentic. There's nothing to indicate where it came from.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And that was a big issue.
Okay, but let me ask Colin this. When we went into court on that, I was in court with the FBI disc, the authentic FBI disc that was contained on, and the judge would not allow Craig Neely to call witnesses.
Right.
So, I mean, it could have been authenticated right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Should have been, it sounds like. So this is, yeah, definitely a ripe issue for federal review if Tammy got good insight from being there. I don't know why the judge was not allowing for authenticating witnesses, but it seems like this should be pretty easy to authenticate.
Right. So he doesn't allow it. Then he says, that's the reason I can't.
Right.
We can't raise it.
Yeah. I'll see if I can find the language in there as we move on to other questions.
Yeah. But the other issue I want to raise with you, Tammy, is the fact that there are different. Can you please talk about this? I think this is wild. Different versions of the same documents.
Yes. That is something that we just discovered. When the federal court granted the limited discovery, there were multiple versions of different reports, the forensic reports. And all the ones that were handed over to the defense at time of trial, they were clean. There was nothing on them. The other versions had handwritten notes all over them. And on the stand, the prosecutor said he acknowledged that, yes, there were different versions. And he also said, I don't know which version the defense got. So that in itself, you know, I mean, that could have opened up a big avenue for who wrote these notes, what these different notes meant.
Other than the notes, were there any differences in the versions? Because where the notes were just kind of like maybe subsequent thoughts of the, I mean, like, it's just odd to me. It makes no sense because how, I'm assuming those notes were also created contemporaneously as the reports were being written, right? Like, so I don't know, whoever created the report writes a handwritten note in the corner or whatever. So then how did you end up with two different versions? You have the computerized report, and then these are the ones that somebody printed out and then wrote on them. Is that what you think happened?
That's possible because some of them were basically like, you know, hairs to room 309 and different notes such as that. So it is possible that as different investigators got the evidence, they were making notes on stuff. But we don't know. That's the whole thing. We don't know. And we don't know what all the notes pertain to. And we don't know how much of them were taken off.
Right. The point being that if defense counsel did not have access to the full document, like with the notes and everything, like how that would have affected their preparation and her defense of her in that time. Colin, what do you think about that? The fact that there are different versions of these like official reports?
It's weird. We kind of saw it in Adnan's case too, right? When it had like the Lotus files and then the
right.
FOIA document or the MPIA document.
Yeah.
And there were slightly different versions of the two.
Well, what I remember is like the redactions. Uh-huh. But I don't remember like them being actually different versions.
I might be misremembering, but I thought there was something where there were some slight differences in a few documents.
Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe. All right. So that is that. Okay, so there's a couple questions about Fonda Eggers. Fonda Eggers, again, was the lady who apparently did the surveillance. She was the animal abuse investigator. I'm just going to kind of clump all these together. Faith asks, was the surveillance ever even mentioned in court? I thought it wasn't brought up at all, but it's sort of muddled right now. But I do remember they put Fonda Eggers on the stand. And then Tara Lee Platt asks, other than her testimony, meaning other than her statement to Margaret Sneary, is there anything to support Fonda Eggers' claim that she gave police her surveillance notes, or do we just have her word? So, Tammy, I'll let you take that.
No, I believe that we just have Fonda's words that she gave those notes to the PSP troopers.
Right.
I don't think the PSP troopers mentioned them at all.
No, nobody mentions them. So, but the fact that she says she, look, the thing is, it's like, the reason I believe her is like, why would she make that up? Why would she make that up? I absolutely believe that she took notes because she was trying to get Patty. She wanted her out. She was trying to get dirt on her. She was trying to she's a professional investigator. She's trying to invest. And if you're investigating something, you're going to document what you're seeing, right? Like, she's trying to find a reason to get Patty out of the county. But here's the thing. Yeah, that's not testimony. That's a statement she made to Margaret. It could have become testimony if, like, it's an issue that could have been raised as a subsequent hearing and get her, like, on the stand to testify or get her deposed. It just never got that far. Faith also says, I don't think there's any avenue for relief since, in theory, Eggers knew Patty never left North Carolina but still got on the stand to testify. This is interesting, though. So, Tammy, Eggers does testify, but she testifies about the animal abuse investigation that led to the hearing that took place that same week that Joe disappeared, but she doesn't testify at all to the surveillance she did. Do you think it's strange? Or do you think she doesn't understand the relevance of her surveillance? What do you think was going on that she never mentioned it?
Well, I don't think that she was asked about it, number one.
The door never opened. Okay.
Right. The door never opened. And I would think she probably knew that the relevance of it. And like you said, this was a relationship that was not a good relationship. She didn't like Patty Rohrer. So would she have gone out of her way to try to help her? I don't know.
Yeah.
But she was not asked about it by either the prosecution or the defense. So.
Well, the defense counsel would have no way of knowing it, period.
Right.
Right. At that time. Yeah.
Investigating wrongful conviction cases can mean facing hard questions and heavy emotions. Talkspace makes support easier to reach with licensed therapists and nurse practitioners across all 50 states. Choose therapy through live chat, video, or audio sessions and fit care into a busy routine. Plans start at $69 per week and most insured members pay $0. If the match does not feel right, switching providers costs nothing extra. Support is available for individuals, teens, and couples. Taking care of mental health can be one steady step when life feels difficult to sort through. Talkspace is in-network with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month when you go to Talkspace.com and enter promo code SPACE80. That's SPACE80. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com.
Okay, speaking of another one of Patty's alibis, and this is a question a few folks have raised, and for some reason, I don't think I ever actually asked Patty. So Patty was asked to keep the grain receipts, right? And she says on that Thursday she bought grain. Where was that receipt? Like, she's very quickly after this disappearance, I mean, within a week, I think she was questioned. Did she already get rid of the grain receipt? Do you have any idea what happened to that from that week?
Well, according to Patty, she did keep all of the grain receipts, and that officer came, the animal control man came and looked at those receipts in February. And after he came, she asked him, do I have to keep these? And he said, not the ones I've already seen, but any future ones. So according to her, now they never asked her for those grain receipts, the police, until they, you know, went after her hard and heavy in April after Joanne and Alex were found.
Right. So, and when she's questioned in December, and I think she's first interviewed December 21st or 22nd, something like that. She's being questioned about Andy. She's not really being questioned. It doesn't seem like she's being questioned really hard, but she does still raise that this is what she was doing. Cause they asked her, what were you doing last week? And she still raises it, but it doesn't seem like for some reason, she doesn't mention the grain that she has a receipt then. Maybe she doesn't realize that she's a suspect at that point and can't imagine it. But she knows that Andy called her, or called her mother at least, you know, to look for her. So there's some question about where she is. But it, like you said, I don't think she realized she was an actual suspect, a serious suspect, until she got rid of the receipt.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, she didn't. And in fact, you know, the police reports do say that They were questioning Patty to build a stronger case against Andy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the questioning all was about Andy until the very end, you know, which is when they said, and what were you doing? And this was 1 week. You know, you got to remember, too, this is exactly 1 week after Joanne and Alex disappeared.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and she gave the same alibis she's still giving today, you know, which was yeah. the nightclub and the grain and the kerosene or gas. So. Yeah.
All right. So I have a question from Amy Henderson. This actually goes back to Andy's mom. So I'm just going to I should address it earlier. But anyway, she's like, I'd love to know if the police put any real effort into verifying whether or not Andy's mom was at home waiting all afternoon or not. What if she left at some point? Was it even there? I feel like they should have gone door to door in her neighborhood to ask neighbors if they saw her or Andy's dad coming, going. So just to address that, I have never seen a single police report showing that they did any investigation on that front or that they did any canvassing in that neighborhood. What about you, Tammy?
Nope. None.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, weird. If he was a suspect initially, why don't you think they didn't drill down on the parents then? Like, do you think there's a connection? Was there any, were the parents connected? They were from there. They were from Caddy, right?
Not Caddy. They were in Bethlehem.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, like, same area.
Yeah, they all kind of merge into each other down there, those towns.
Yeah. So they're longtime residents. Do you think they had, maybe his dad had some connection to folks in the forest, and that's why they kind of didn't really drill down? Did you ever find that?
I have been told that before. I've been told that Andy's father was big in Bethlehem Steel, and he was, you know, he was a pretty I don't want to say powerful, like, you know, but he was a very well known. And so I have heard that before, but I have not found any evidence that anything was going on like that.
This question from Tara Lee Platt. Colin, do you want to take that?
Yeah, this kind of builds into something I wanted to ask Tammy about from her research. She writes, hey, UK longtime listener, first time poster here. Forgive me if I'm being dense and it's not relevant to Patty's case, but I'm so confused by the potential land purchase by Joe and Andy. If the current owner was keeping their mortgage on the land, what were they paying for exactly? How would it be their land? So, Tammy, I'm right. I think we reported this, the last addendum, right? That the day Joe disappears is the day that Andy and she had to make the decision on the land in Colorado. Is that right?
That is true, yes.
Okay. And from all of your research, do you think that Andy and Joe were in a position at that point to execute this deal on the land in Colorado?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I mean, they just weren't. It was an impossibility. And I think that the Colorado move was a dream of Andy's. And I mm-hmm. think Joanne was kind of placating that dream. You know? Yeah. Because
right.
I think Joanne knew, we can't do this.
And but do then you think when, if what if the plan was to sell the house in Caddy? I mean, then maybe they could have.
That wasn't Andy's house.
Oh,
the house
no,
was
okay.
in his father and sister's name.
Yeah.
But Andy did lie to the police and tell them that's how he planned to finance the trip, mm-hmm. by selling his house. But it wasn't his house. And then you have to remember that, you know, they were going to build their own house. Andy was going to build it. Where were they going to get the money for that? They were going to have to rent while they were doing that. Andy wouldn't have been working while he was doing that. I mean, it was just, you know, it was, I think it was a dream. And I think yes. Joanne was playing along with it, figuring it's never going to happen. And then this fire sale property came up and it's like, whoa, all of a sudden this could be doable because he's willing to hold the mortgage for us.
Uh-huh.
And I think that that may have led to a humongous fight because...
Right.
You know, it was Joanne who told her, no, we're not buying it.
Mm. I mean, Tara's asking like kind of like the how this actually works, like, you know, legally, like, you know, like if somebody else, if the current owners, are they a guarantor on the mortgage? Is Andy and Joe's name? I mean, basically, there's the current owner would hold the mortgage because Andy and Joe could not have, or Andy at least couldn't have qualified for it. And then they would have just done a contract with these folks who are purchasing from them. And I assume that's right. Am I right, Colin, there?
I'm not sure about this particular. I mean, that's one way.
Generally how it's done.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, structure. Yeah. I don't know. Tammy might know more about the mechanics of this particular interaction.
But it didn't seem like it was going to happen anyways.
Yeah.
The pie in the sky. All right. So we have a question from Sybil Petrie. Did they talk about fingerprints in the car, the baby stuff? I'm sure it might have been too long, especially the bodies being found outside. But I honestly don't remember them talking about fingerprints. Did they fingerprint the house? Okay. So she's talking about fingerprints. Now, one thing I do remember, Tammy, from your book, you reported that there are three prints found inside the car, two on the baby car seat and one on the scrap of paper. And one of the things you note, which is weird, is that initially they ran the prints through AFIS, which is a fingerprint database. And one of the prints they showed from the car seat was from some woman in Philadelphia. And that's how you have it notated. I don't know exactly what that means. But by the time they got to trial, they said that the prints were either Andy's or Joe's sister Peggy. And that was it. So who is this woman from Philadelphia?
So it was just when they put it through AFIS, AFIS hit on this woman. The print was close enough to hit on her as her print.
Oh,
now,
okay.
When they got to trial, they said, well, when they looked at it closer, you know, it they determined it actually had come from Joanne's sister.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, look, fingerprint science is like a lot. I mean, like you have a human examiner just, right? I mean, they use a human examiner just kind of like comparing it visually. So that could explain it. But what about prints inside the house, prints from the, like the baby stuff? What can you tell us about that?
As far as I know, they didn't find anything that...
Suspicious, right?
Suspicious, yes. I don't even know if they fingerprinted the house.
Mm. I don't remember seeing that the house was fingerprinted. I do believe, like, the baby's diaper bag was fingerprinted. And
yes.
I think, like, the formula box, those things. But, again, there was no report of... I mean, I don't know if it was wiped off or something. I don't remember any report of anybody's prints being on there, to be honest. All right. So do you want to lead us into Shell's question, Colin?
Yeah, this is from Shell Walker. I know the police were monitoring Joe's credit cards after she'd been reported missing. Has anyone looked into her credit history, especially for anomalies? If Andy did that to Patty, he's probably done it before or after. Like, was he treating the new wife to a life of luxury on Joe's dime/credit? Murdering Joe could have been over her finding out about finances and not another woman. And so, Tammy, that's part of what we were just discussing. But, yeah, do we know, was there tracking of Joe's credit cards after she's reported missing?
I know for a certain amount of time there was. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long, though.
Anything suspicious that came up from that?
Not initially, no.
Okay.
No.
You know, I'm going to go ahead and raise something that... our researcher, Jen, raised with me earlier, too, and I saw this, but it's hard to understand. Well, it's kind of hard to understand if it's relevant at all, but she raised it again today. So I'm just going to go ahead and read what she wrote to us. She said, look, there's a phone call that Joanne's mother gets in January of 1995. So this is about a month after Joe's gone missing. And it's from Marine Midland Bank, which is a bank that has branches in New York and New Jersey, my understanding is. The caller is looking for somebody named Joanne O'Connor, okay? Now, the mother, she calls the detective, the police, and she's like, I just got this call from this bank, and they're looking for my daughter. They you know, they used her name, and I don't know what's going on. So detectives then call the bank, and they're like, what's going on? Well, they talk to somebody there at the bank, and that person says, oh, yeah, like, we were looking for somebody named Joanne O'Connor, but it was a different Joanne because she has a different Social Security number. Then, in the police report, it says that then they asked about, and I don't know why they would ask this, but they asked if the bank has anything for Alex Katernack. Alex is the baby. I don't know why the detectives would ask them that, like why. But so according to that guy, he's like, yeah, there is one person named Alex Katernack who has a loan out in his name from our bank. But here's the thing. According to Jen, our incredible researcher, she says, there's only actually one person she could find on all of Ancestry.com that had that exact name, Alex Katernack, spelled just like that. And that's the baby. There's two other people who had a similar name, but there's like one letter was off. But at the time this happened in 1995, one of them was already dead. They had died in 1960. And the other would have been in their 80s at the time. So the only person that she could find on Ancestry.com that had this name spelled exactly the way the baby's name is spelled, Alex Katernack, was the baby. And that's the person apparently on this loan document, according to the police report. What does that mean? Could Andy have taken a loan out in the baby's name at the time? I don't know. I mean, it's just, it's that whole thing is this kind of this weird data point where this bank is calling about somebody named Joanne O'Callaghan, and then they also have a loan out in the name of Alex Katranek. So I don't know.
Yeah. Here I have my biggest loose end.
Yeah.
In the next comment by a listener, I'm very curious to hear what Tammy has to say about this. And I think the defense, assuming the vehicle still existed when Patty was arrested, should have tested this themselves. But Lucy writes, did the police verify anything to do with the faults on Patricia's vehicle with regard to only being able to do 35 miles per hour? I can't get over the fact that it would have taken 10 hours or so for her to get back in a working car, going at around the speed limit for a lot of the journey. I'm assuming some of that would have been highways with a speed limit well over 35 miles per hour. So for Patricia to get back from the 9 a.m. phone call would have been impossible. Love the show and the work you do. I read Tammy's book and loved it. Sending this from the UK. Tammy, what do we know about Patty's vehicle in terms of the speed it could drive and any testing that was done on it?
Well, according to Patty, the U-joint was bad in the the vehicle. So that had to be replaced, and it would only go 35 miles. She couldn't go over 35 or it would start to shake and shimmy. Now, she did have a receipt for a new U-joint, which had been purchased, I believe it might have been December 10th, even.
It was the weekend prior, yeah.
Yeah, and that her father, her stepfather, Ray, did testify that he had planned to put it on the weekend of the 17th, which would have been the weekend after Joanne vanished. So, and I believe her boyfriend at the time, Brian, also testified that the U-joint, he was aware of that in the van and that the van couldn't go over 35. So that's as much as I know.
So the state's claim might be the U-joint was actually purchased before the murder. And so even though the father's saying I installed it after, it's possible he put it in before. That's what they're saying.
Exactly. Okay. Yes.
But did the police verify anything? No, I don't think they looked at the vehicle. I don't think the defense did any of that as well.
No.
Yeah. Okay. So I think this is basically the last couple of questions. And this comes from Brittany McCullough. This is for Tammy. Has this case inspired you to investigate and write about others like it?
that's a difficult question because, you know, honestly, had I known what I was getting into with this, am I positive I still would have done it? Yeah, I'm not. This case has taken 15 years of my life. But if I were contacted by another person and I truly believe they were wrongfully convicted, yes, I would do it again because it's the right thing to do. So
that's how we ended up where we are today. Tammy, we didn't expect to do this for 10 years later. Yeah. Okay. And final question is Sybil Petri says, what's the next step to get her exonerated? I do feel like we kind of talked about this with Tammy. Tell us, what do you think's going to happen next?
Well, she's going to go into federal court. She has a lot of constitutional violations, and I think she's going to get some kind of relief. What it's going to be, I don't know. But I do think she has a good chance this time, the best chance she's probably ever had.
If she wins in federal court, what does that do? Does that mean the federal court can like grant her an exoneration? Does that mean it's sent back to state court? What does that look like? Do you know? Colin, do you know?
Tammy, do you know, is it a petition for writ of habeas corpus?
It is.
It
okay,
is, yeah.
Then, yeah, they could overturn her convictions.
And that's what we'll hope for.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Tammy. Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners before we wrap up? And I know I'm saying this is actually the final episode that we're going to be reporting on this case. If there's updates, obviously, we'll come back and let you know. But Tammy, any closing thoughts?
No, just, you know, keep the faith and hopefully something will happen and you will be able to update it.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you for all the work you've done in this. And folks, if you haven't read Tammy's book, please go out and read it. It's called Convenient Suspect. It's available hard copy, Kindle. I have them all. I have every version available. Colin, anything from you before we wrap up?
You mentioned the Joey Watkins case earlier. I never thought I would see such chain of custody issues in a case ever again. And this case with the hair evidence is just an embarrassment of forensic science. And if nothing else, everything that was done and misdone with the hair should lead to her conviction being thrown out.
Great. Thank you so much. And it will be. Fingers crossed. Fingers crossed and prayers up, as I always say. All right. Thank you guys so much. Thank you guys for tuning in. We are going to be back this week with our unfiltered episodes where we talk about stuff in the news. We haven't done that in a while. And Colin is gearing up for a new season. And then in the interim, we've got some great interviews coming up. So, you know, thanks for listening. And we'll be back in a few days. All right. Thank you so much, Tammy.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
If you want even more undisclosed content, remember you can become a patron by signing up at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And if you've got feedback for us, you can find us at speakpipe.com/undisclosed, where you can leave us an actual voice note. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at undisclosedpod. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at undisclosedpod. And we've got our own little private Facebook group called the Toward Justice Community. All you gotta do is answer 3 quick questions and I will let you in. You can follow me, Rabia, on Instagram at Rabia2, the number 2. And you can follow Colin at EvidenceProf on X and Blue Sky. Follow the podcast on X at UndisclosedPod. We want to thank our sponsors, and I want to thank our intrepid team, our sound editor, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Methil Thelhan, and my amazing investigator, Jennifer Leahy. And a very special thank you to true crime author and advocate, Tammy Mall, who made this season possible. Thank you, Tammy, for all your work.